This program is intended for individuals who are blind or are unable to read physical print and is brought to you by CABVI's Audio Information Services team.
Welcome to Radio Reading Services and the Smithsonian Magazine for their joint April-May 2024 issue. I am your host, Gail Fisher. We're picking up and finishing the article we started last week entitled Slugs in Paradise by Helen Sullivan. We read about psychedelic hedgehogs, purple pineapples, living strawberries, and we're welcomed to the magical world of nudibranchs. Finishing up the article. It is almost easier to believe that Pokemon are real than it is to believe that nudibranchs are. They're just too weird, too brightly colored and rabbit-shaped, too adorable to exist. At night, Parker says, he and Cobb dive with an ultraviolet lamp under which the nudibranchs glow in even weirder ways. Toward the end of the dive, I turn a rock over and find a large, slug-like creature. It is deep purple, with a frilly orange and lilac border, which it waves vigorously. I sign bunny ears at Cobb. But this is no nudibranch. It is a flatworm pretending to be a nudibranch so that predators will mistake it for something venomous. As we watch, two rhinophores appear to poke out from its body. The worm has curled two small sections of its wavy edge into two very thin waves, imitating the bunny ears. Nudibranchs have such good defense mechanisms, are so good at surviving, that other soft body animals on the reef have evolved to copy them. They have seen sea cucumbers that have evolved to have the same coloration as their local nudibranchs. But one threat nudibranchs are not prepared for is ocean acidification, which can stop larvae from forming their shells, which then stops them from being able to disperse. For outside observers, though, nudibranchs make good indicator species when it comes to climate change. They are brightly colored, so it is easy to track their movements. It is obvious when they are sort of entering or leaving an area, and that can be really good for trying to understand the impact of temperature changes on an environment. Goodhart has a hunch that nudibranch's ability to ingest and use the organelles, parts of a cell, of another organism may have implications for medicine. Researchers are trying to work out how to use organelles like mitochondria and lysosomes to deliver other drugs. By studying the mechanisms and genes that let nudibranchs process and use the nematicides from other creatures, they hope to advance drug research in humans. Then again, nudibranchs needn't be good for anything. Simply getting to know them, knowing that they exist, where and how they live, and what they are, already seems wonderful. Over the course of our two-hour dive, we see 24 nudibranch species and a total of about 200 individuals. A slow morning for Cobb, who once saw 1,000 individuals in 5 hours. Afterward, as the divers devour bowls of fries and plates of eggs and toast, they discuss their helpless love of slugs. "It's like a disease," Roberts says. Wright agrees. "Now I infect other people." "It's a thing that spreads," Parker says. "We tried not to become nudibranch nerds," Forey says, turning to me. And Roberts jumps in. "But after so many times of saying, 'It's that one with the stripes and yellow,' you decide to just learn their names." Not only have they learned their names, they've given at least one individual nudibranch a name of its own, Ceratosoma Tenu. They'd seen on multiple dives and recognized because it was missing a rhinophore and had a big scar running down its side. "We named him Scarface," says Wright, and picks up her phone so I can say hello to her little friend. She had set the slug as her background. Turning to another part of our world across the ocean, we start an article entitled Las Vegas, Bets on the Future, by Daniel Rothberg. As the Southwest dries, can a city notorious for excess find a way to survive with less and less water? Anything goes in Las Vegas except excessive water use. 2 decades ago, the city began to grapple with a reality that many other cities in the Southwest were trying to put off. Eventually, it could run out of water. In contrast with cities like Phoenix or Los Angeles, which get water from a number of sources, Las Vegas still gets about 90% of its water from the Colorado River, and it has little other water to tap into. By the time the river hit a record low in 2002, Las Vegas had begun taking aggressive water-saving measures to meet population growth and adapt to a drying river. The city, known for excess and summer pool parties, began counting every drop, even the small dribbles flowing onto asphalt. "We couldn't have made additional water commitments," says John Ensminger, the Southern Nevada Water Authority's general manager. "No more homes, no more casinos, no population growth at all." Today's signs of growth in Las Vegas are unavoidable. Traffic, new buildings, a push to open federal public land for private development. At a diner in downtown Las Vegas, where construction cranes mark the sky, State Assemblyman Howard Watts III, who has sponsored a slate of recent Las Vegas conservation bills, says growth is something the city continues to grapple with, and a lot comes right down to how water is managed. "What's the water bottom line going to be?" he asks. "And how do you make that math work?" The restrictions in place in Las Vegas include limiting pool sizes, permitting cooling systems that pass air over evaporated water, also known as swamp coolers, in new buildings, issuing fines when water leaks onto sidewalks, restricting personal car washing to once a week, and prohibiting homes from having fountains or decorative ponds larger than 10 square feet. Vegas has also successfully incentivized the removal of roughly 200 million square feet of turf, saving more than 10% of Nevada's Colorado River allocation. The state is allotted about 1.8% of the river's total water supply. Taken together, the city's water restrictions have freed up room for growth. Over the past 2 decades, Southern Nevada added about 750,000 residents while reducing Colorado River water consumption by 31%, according to one official. But the need for conservation has become even more pressing. In 2022, Lake Mead and Lake Powell, the two largest reservoirs in the United States, both fed by the Colorado River, were again at record lows. Federal water officials warned that major cutbacks were necessary in some of the states that rely on the Colorado River: Nevada, Arizona, and California. In response, the federal government declared its authority in a worst-case shortage crisis to make sweeping water cuts to cities across the Southwest. Such a scenario was avoided following a wet winter in early 2023, but climate scientists expect the overtapped watershed to provide less and less water in the future. The Phoenix area and other cities are now facing pressure to catch up with Las Vegas as the Southwest becomes even more arid. Phoenix proper gets only about one-third of its water from the Colorado River. But outside its city limits, areas like Scottsdale are more dependent on the river. Scottsdale asked its residents to reduce water use by 5%, stopped homeowners associations from requiring overseeding lawns, and banned the use of grass in front of yards for new developments. In an especially dramatic move, Scottsdale cut off water to the Rio Verde foothills, an outlying community of 2,000 homes. The community was built by so-called wildcat developers who avoided official requirements for subdivisions. Arizona's Groundwater Management Act, passed in 1980, requires developers in urban areas to prove that they can meet residents' water needs for the next 100 years. The developers behind Rio Verde foothills took advantage of legal loopholes to sidestep this requirement. So people went ahead and bought homes there, even though Rio Verde foothills lies beyond the reach of Scottsdale's pipe systems, and the groundwater isn't plentiful enough for all residents to access wells. For decades, many of the households in Rio Verde foothills had their water hauled in from Scottsdale's water supply. But in 2022, Scottsdale announced that it would stop supplying that water. "There is no Santa Claus," declared Scottsdale Mayor David Ortega in a statement on December 9, 2022, echoing the kinds of warnings Las Vegas officials had been issuing for years. "The mega drought tells us all, water is not a compassion game." Scottsdale later agreed to keep supplying water until the end of 2025, though it's bringing in that supply from outside contractors. Eventually, Rio Verde foothills will find its own source of water. Cameron Donnarumma is a Las Vegas water waste investigator, or water cop, and he usually rolls out in his patrol car at 4 a.m. before residents power up their sprinklers. Each address has a mandated watering time, which changes seasonally and is designed to minimize freezing and evaporation. His job, laid out on a flashy decal wrapped around the side of the car, is, quote, "to protect and conserve," end quote. Before the sun rises, he gets a firsthand look at the changing landscape of the Las Vegas Valley, where lush green plots have been replaced with rocks, succulents, flowering bushes, and long, scrubby desert grasses. In 2021, the Nevada legislature required the removal of sidewalk and median turf by 2026. Yard signs mark patches of dry grass along sidewalks, curbs, and artificial lakes. This turf removal is mandated by state law AB 356, the signs tell residents. Once an emerald patchwork in the desert, the grass is no longer watered. It's on its way out, as are hundreds more acres of turf across the Las Vegas Valley, which get about 4 inches of rain each year. On a recent ride-along, Donnarumma flared bright amber strobe lights as he drove his car into a community in northwest Las Vegas. It was not long before he spotted a sprinkler run afoul. The violation was the most common issue he sees: water leaving the property and running into the street. Since it was the household's first offense, it got off with a warning. Another violation will come with an $80 fine, doubling from there. But speaking with a customer face-to-face is even better. "We're not here to be scary and to be bullies," he says. "We're here to educate customers." Not everybody appreciates the lesson. One citizens group, the Water Fairness Coalition, has appeared at recent county meetings to question for whom they are making sacrifices. Why should they forego water to make room for growth? What about the farmers who use about 80% of the Colorado River compared with the sliver Las Vegas gets? And what will happen to the old growth trees? Norm Schilling, a local landscaper and co-host of the show Desert Bloom on Las Vegas's NPR affiliate, sees this tension encapsulated in an old walnut tree. Standing in the front yard of one of his customers' homes in McNeil Estates, where older homes have lush landscapes, he points to a walnut tree flanked by grass. Schilling says its roots still need grass to survive. He worries that new excessive use fees could force residents to rip up healthy, shady trees and replace them with smaller, less mature trees, albeit more drought-resistant ones. Schilling wants the Water Authority to slow down, preserve existing trees, adjust fees more gradually, and phase in change. Let us nurture the urban forest the way we have, he says, and let us have a very thoughtful, timely transition. Las Vegas's water officials insist that their conservation plan is sound. To tree lovers like Schilling, they say that there are ways to keep trees alive without thirsty lawns and sprinkling systems. For instance, applying water directly to the tree's roots using a soil probe. They also say that the rate of structure for water usage fees is fair, noting that the top 10% of residential users consume most of the water. The thresholds for single-family homes change each season, ranging from 14,000 gallons in the winter to 28,000 gallons in summer, and residents have to pay $9 for every 1,000 gallons they go over the limit. Last year, a water official said he couldn't imagine that people would argue that their landscaping matters more than their neighbors do if deep Colorado River cuts come. From the sky, golf courses appear as conspicuous exception, but even they have trimmed back. Golf courses in Vegas have a limited water budget, and that budget is tightening this year. Country clubs have been forced to pull out non-functional turf and make other big changes. Anthem Country Club, about 15 miles from the Las Vegas Strip, traded its original rye grass, which stays greener at cold temperatures, for Bermuda grass, which turns browner in the winter but requires less water. The city is also paying close attention to commercial newcomers, making sure they'll be amenable to conservation. Recently, officials unveiled a tool to rank the expected water use of companies eyeing Las Vegas. The tool produces an overall water score that is then balanced with other factors like job creation and average salary. But that kind of strategic thinking isn't the biggest challenge the officials say they face. I know it sounds simplistic to say making people change their behavior is the hardest part, says Entsminger, sitting in an executive office that overlooks the Las Vegas Valley. But that's always the hardest part. Every group we talk to says, we fully support your conservation programs, but how do we get a carve-out for our little piece? His response? There's no silver bullet. This is a silver buckshot, and every single pellet is needed. We turn our attention now to an article in the prologue section, specifically The Past is Prologue. This is from the American Icon tab and written by Sonia Anderson, entitled Sweet Dreams, the tangy tale of how America's children learn to squeeze life for all it's worth. In the fall of 1839, New York City's Apollo Saloon hosted a ladies' fair, complete with live music, displays of artisan goods, and, of course, refreshments. As the Daily Herald reported, from the post office to the lemonade stand, Bright eyes and smiling faces peered forth, as if heaven had at last been let loose and got a holiday. This rhapsodic description of a sun-kissed fête is also the first recorded mention of that most American of fixtures, the pop-up vendor hawking lemonade. Though today's kids might not know it, their operation is the result of 200 years of sweat and ingenuity. Since lemonade stands first began spreading across the country in the 19th century, they have served as grifters' street hustles, legitimate cash cows, and instruments of charity. They've also become increasingly dominated by pipsqueak entrepreneurs who thereby learn what one can accomplish through sheer pluck. The American lemonade business began in the mid-1800s, just as the Industrial Revolution's peak. Lemonade vendors infiltrated New York's thriving street food scene, and many of them were pretty dodgy. One journalist complained of dirty-looking lemonade composed of molasses, vinegar, and water. On the other hand, many New Yorkers praised these new quaffing opportunities. Before, a thirsty soul, quote-unquote, would have paid 15 cents for a glass in some barroom, the New York Times reported in 1880. Whereas now, a customer can have a glass of ice-cold lemonade made before his eyes for 5 cents. Back then, though, selling lemonade was a grown-up's business. For one thing, the average child of the era didn't have much time to experiment with entrepreneurship. Daniel Cook, professor of childhood studies at Rutgers University, Camden, says that in many poor families at the time, children were laborers who obeyed, not self-starting retailers. They worked either in industry as clothing manufacturers, newsies, and even miners, or at home, tending their family's farm or caring for siblings. There was no sense of being able to afford 10 to 12 years of non-productive life for a child in the family like we have now, Cook says. It was only after the turn of the century that the typical lemonade vendor got younger, as upward economic trends led to freer children. In the early 1900s, the Industrial Revolution gave way to the Progressive Era, and with it emerged a new middle class. As job conditions and wages improved, many Americans decamped from cities to the suburbs, where their children had much more space and much more time. Americans became less worried about their children's utility and more attentive to their development and happiness. By 1918, every state had passed laws mandating that children attend school. This meant the emergence of summer vacation, and as children began to seek both pocket change and entertainment, the lemonade stand, offering the chance to play at business and for a cash reward, no less, presented itself as an apt activity. Across the country, kids took up the pitcher, sometimes most charitably. In 1910, the Indianapolis News lauded three young girls whose lemonade sales realized 85 cents for the babies of Cherryvale. In 1915, some children in St. Louis raised $3, around $91 in today's money, during a summer fundraiser for a charity providing milk to poor infants. And by 1921, lemonade stands run by children were a main revenue stream for the event. A widely circulated bedtime tale of the period featured a pair of anthropomorphic young rabbits, Buster and Duster, who set up a lemonade stand in the woods expecting to earn enough to purchase, quote, an automobile maybe, or an airship, end quote. A lemonade stand was capacious enough for dreams of all kinds. Of course, the whole run-by-children thing isn't always conducive to safe practices, and there have been some public health scares over the years. In the 1940s, one little girl accidentally caused a polio outbreak by failing to wash her cups. In more recent years, a dozen young lemonade vendors in states ranging from New York to California made news when local authorities cracked down on their unlicensed driveway businesses. But legislatures have stepped in to mount a hearty defense of the lemonade stand. In recent years, Georgia and Texas both passed laws ensuring that lemonade stands would be free of most regulation. Pennsylvania and New York have called for the same. One state senator grew quite passionate in asserting the need to protect the entrepreneurial dreams of children. The lemonade stand lost some of its practical value over time. Americans can now buy lemonade in bulk at any supermarket or convenience store. It's also not as common anymore. 40% of the baby boomers reported running a stand as a child. Today, as Cook says, many parents have pulled their children back from the public sphere for safety reasons. But the lemonade stand remains every American child's birthright. Though most states still require a permit to run one, the public tends collectively to exempt street-side lemonade purveyors from adhering to the law. Not because kids make better lemonade than Minute Maid, but because we want to encourage their dreams. The resulting enterprise, child-run, unlicensed, and tax-free, held on throughout history, becoming a summertime mainstay, animated by a sense of heady possibility. When I was a kid, my brother and I ran an annual lemonade stand from the foot of our driveway in Michigan. The cars would pull in from the main road, directed by our taped-up signs, and neighbors bought our Dixie cups sloshing with powdery lemonade. I preferred the afternoons when we packed up our supplies and walked our change-filled pockets to the drugstore to buy slushies. But sometimes our charitable neighbor would help out, and she usually sealed our hard-earned quarters in an envelope addressed to the Red Cross. I didn't protest. We'd had our fun all the same. It looks like we have time for one question to ask Smithsonian. Lucas Zhang of Lexington, Massachusetts asks, how do we measure Earth's diameter? The Earth's circumference was first calculated in 200 BC by the Greek mathematician Eratosthenes, based on the length and angles of shadows between the Egyptian cities of Alexandria and Cyrene. His result would put the polar diameter at 7,850 miles, only 50 miles shy of the actual polar diameter. Unlike Eratosthenes, we now know that Earth is not a perfect sphere. Its diameter changes slightly and depending on your latitude. Today, satellites can analyze distances along with gravitational fields and light waves to get precise measurements. But it is incredible that Eratosthenes was able to get so close. And this was answered by James T. Haber, Earth and Planetary Sciences Fellow at the National Air and Space Museum. And that concludes our reading of Smithsonian Magazine for April and May 2024 for this week. On behalf of Radio Reading Services, this has been Gail Fisher. We thank you so much for tuning us in and listening this week. We wish you a great day, a wonderful week ahead, and as always, please stay safe and healthy.